right, welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show, we are talking about One Night in Miami, the directorial debut from Regina King, about a fictionalized night in Miami when Malcolm X, Cassius Clay, Jim Brown, and Sam Cooke all met in a hotel room and what might have happened. And it's a really interesting movie, really great movie, and one that I was really happy to talk about with my guest co-host, David Quinones, from our other podcast, Bird Road. So we've got that coming up here in a second, but before we get into it, I want to, of course, as always, remind you to make sure you're subscribed to Piecing It Together and Bird Road while you're at it. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find us on, of course, Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, but we're on Pocket Casts, we're on all of them, you know, also on Podchaser and all that stuff, and you can rate and review us. You could also follow us on social media at Piecing Pod, join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, and don't forget to check out our website, piecingpod.com, where we got a lot of great content, all the old episodes, a bunch of other bonus stuff too, and we're planning a lot of new things for this new year to go specifically on the website, so you can sign up for our mailing list while you're there, and you'll find out about it as soon as it starts going up. So, with all that said, let's get into our conversation about One Night in Miami. All right, so Q is back on the show with us today about One Night in Miami. Q, how you doing?
Pretty good. Thank you very much for thinking of me when it came to this this tome on Black excellence.
Yes. Well, let it be said that when I first saw that there was a movie coming out called One Night in Miami, it was Regina King's directorial debut, and it was, you know, coming out at the time where it was going to be, you know, big awards contender and all that, but I didn't even know what it was about. I just said, "Oh, One Night in Miami, I got to have Q on." And so there we are. Now I know what it's about, and maybe I wouldn't have had you on, but I'm sure we'll have a good conversation.
What the fuck? You know, this is where identity politics gets you, man.
Yeah,
backed up against the wall where you feel bad about inviting your best friend,
mm-hmm.
who's lived in Miami for 15 years.
Yeah,
onto
well, this
show.
Movie is specifically about Miami, like that. It couldn't have taken place anywhere else, right?
Well, it's funny because I saw somebody write that the Hampton House, which has. Sort of, it's like the Hampton House is still around here in Miami, but it's in a different part of town, and it's become more of like a historical preservation society. But in this movie, it plays like a, like almost like a silent fifth character, kind of. It's like the backdrop for, you know, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but it's a backdrop for everything that happens. It's this, it was this, you know, place in Overtown, which is prior to being called Overtown, was called Colored Town. In kind of in between where Little Havana, what is now Little Havana, and downtown Miami, like kind of in between there, it was this, you know, I think the people who watched Watchmen this year, they became familiar for the first time with Black Wall Street, and Overtown was very much like that. Overtown was this successful epicenter of Black culture in the Jim Crow South, you know, kind of living. Where the residents there like kind of lived as productively and as functionally as you can in a segregated, you know, in the segregated American South for years, for decades, like until the federal government came in and built the I-95 overpass, hence the name, right. Overtown, you know, and started to really degrade the community. And then, of course, when the CIA put drugs in the community in the 80s and the 70s and 80s, that didn't help either. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, no, and that's all just such like a backdrop of this whole thing. And so, you know, definitely the location is a part of it. But that's also a story that happened throughout a lot of major cities throughout this country, especially during that particular time period.
I will say that Miami does not, I don't think, gets the respect that it deserves for being, or maybe honestly the disrepute that it deserves for being ahead of the curve in the civil rights era. Like there were a lot of marches, sit-ins, demonstrations that didn't get the coverage that like Greensboro did or mm-hmm. you know, Selma or a lot of other touchstone moments in the civil rights era. But Miami was first. Miami had a lunch counter sit-in before Greensboro, before mm-hmm. a lot of the more high-profile ones. It was happening here. It was a conversation here. There was, you know, you don't say that there was like money because it's not like there was, it's not like even the most sort of well-to-do Black communities back then weren't like rich or anything like that. They were just doing okay. And that was Overtown. And so that's the kind of places where you would see a lot of these movements pop up. And Miami had had people refusing to move from the front of the bus, Black people refusing to move from the front of the bus before Rosa Parks did it. They had lunch counter sit-ins before the Woolworth in Asheville and the one in Greensboro. And, there were marches here before Selma and before a lot of the other sort of high profile marches. It's kind of lost to history a little bit, but it's awesome that they made this movie and that we get to talk about it.
So CQ was a good pick for my co-host on this episode. So let's start getting into some puzzle pieces here. What do you got for your first puzzle piece for One Night in Miami?
Yeah, let's jump into it. The first one I want to do is there's no chance that anybody other than maybe Regina King, the filmmaker, watch this. Very few people saw it. It was a WLRN production, which is our local NPR affiliate. In the year 2008, they produced a great documentary by the venerable, well-known documentarian Alan Tomlinson called Muhammad Ali Made in Miami. So this documentary focuses on Muhammad Ali during this very formative time where he was at a really young age coming to grips with the way that things were. He came from Louisville, Kentucky. He had never been anywhere like Miami. He had never seen anything like this city. And for him to come here and see that some things from his hometown, despite this international hub of business and, this huge metropolitan area, completely different than where he lived, that some things were still the same, that he wasn't allowed to, they didn't get into it in the movie that much, but the Fifth Street Gym was in this documentary, they talk about the Fifth Street Gym in Miami Beach being this little island of democracy and equality in a sea of segregation because of Miami Beach. As we saw in the movie, if you were Black, unless you were Sam Cooke and you had white people working for you, you weren't allowed to stay in the hotels, right? And the Fifth Street Gym was a place where in Miami Beach where it didn't matter if you were white or Black. All you had to be able to do is fight. If you were a good fighter, you were there, you were in. And now it's like a Burger King. It sucks. But like the Fifth Street Gym is this very, historic space. And Ali, then Clay at the time, as he's known through most of the movie, One Night in Miami, he was confronted with this reality of like going in and training for all this time in this gym where he was treated as an equal by everybody else who came in there, but having to get on a bus or having to, jog or run across the causeway 8 miles back to Overtown every night because he wasn't allowed to stay in a hotel on Miami Beach. And that was this incredibly formative experience for him. Obviously, what came next was the coming out party of somebody who I think is like one of the greatest Americans in the history of our country. I think Muhammad Ali, I have this picture I keep a picture of him here in my studio. He's one of my favorite people of all time. He represents the best things in this country. And I think that a lot of those things were probably always there with him, and they came out during that time. If you want to watch it, I think it's free online. You can find it because it's an NPR, public television show. WLRN produced it. It's called Muhammad Ali Made in Miami. Came out in 2008. Alan Tomlinson, great documentarian too. He passed away a few years ago, but a lot of really good stuff. He's documented Miami for a long time.
He's such a fascinating character, and like there's so much to him, to Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, where, they could make so many movies out of different like periods of his life, different things that he was involved in. And just, I could totally see that being a really interesting documentary. I probably should check it out.
Yeah. I mean, just talk about, and I think a theme that was quiet and they didn't really hit it over the head in this movie was one where they were all four of these guys gave up so much. And you look at them and you're like, Jim Brown was rich and famous for his whole life. And it's like Sam Cooke, yeah, he, you know, he fucked up and got high and got killed. And which, by the way, very much up for debate. I'll let you, all the listeners out there, go do your own research on the death of Sam Cooke and what really went down there. But I'm not going to get too conspiratorial about that. but I mean, like Muhammad Ali, oh, you know, well, he got sick. That's sad. He didn't get to have golden years, as it were, you know, because of, those were robbed of him. And Malcolm X, anybody with a pulse knows what happened to Malcolm X, right? But like, collectively, this group of four men had so many, even the ones who survived, even Jim Brown, even Muhammad Ali, who did live to be an older man, despite, you know, his struggle with Parkinson's, like they lost so much because of the positions that they took. They lost enormous amounts of opportunities. These guys would have been, if they were alive today, they'd have been the LeBron James level of notoriety and fame. And most of them were hated in their heyday. That's the thing. And we're recording this like a week after Martin Luther King Day. And I'm always surprised at like how short our memory is, that when Martin Luther King was assassinated, he was one of the most hated men in America. And that we should always be thinking about that. Like, what the fuck is wrong with us? That this person that we veneer, these four people who we now veneer or revere, I should say, and think about in such positive light, that we hated them in the moment, right? And I say we, like largely white people, we hated them in that moment. And now it's like, oh, well, they get their own special days and cool movies by Regina King that make us feel all warm and fuzzy inside. It's like, yeah, well, okay, maybe you should be a little bit more conscious of the real history, which I think that Regina King did a great job of portraying.
Right. Absolutely.
So what's your first?
So I'm going to get this one out of the way first, just so it could bring up my favorite scene in the movie. And this is not a movie that I think was really influential to the movie, but I just wanted to use it as a puzzle piece anyway. And that's Inside Llewyn Davis from the Coen Brothers, because it's another movie where a singer is made to feel inadequate compared to Bob Dylan. So I just love the scene so much where Malcolm X just totally takes Sam Cooke to task for acting like he can't have a hit and speak on the issues of the day at the same time. And he plays Blowing in the Wind, and it's like, oh, fuck. Yeah, I guess you can, you know, and he has no excuse whatsoever in that moment. And it's just such a wonderful scene. And he's, you know, like I said, made to feel inadequate. It's a different way, but still, the Llewyn Davis character just totally being overshadowed by Bob Dylan and Inside Llewyn Davis, I thought would be a good setup for that conversation.
Great movie, obviously. I just would love to like imagine a cut of Sam Cooke kind of strumming his way, as we see him do, strumming his way through the early chords progression of what will end up being A Change Is Gonna Come, and then just cut to F. Murray Abraham saying, I don't see any money here.
I don't see any money here. One of the best scenes of the last decade, for sure.
Just, I mean, I remember watching that scene, you know, because that's what you're making this about. You're making it specifically, I think, about that, like, gulf. You know, like, what is it? The saying that man's grasp exceeds his reach or whatever. And like that scene, that moment where Oscar Isaac is playing his heart out and it just gets deflated and completely falls out. I mean, the entire texts have been written about that scene. It's great. Really good.
So damn good. Well, what do you got for your next piece?
So for my next piece, I wanted to highlight one of my all-time favorite movies, a little bit problematic. If you have the director Regina King riding a high off of, you know, Watchmen and off of this movie and off of a bunch of other projects as sort of like a woman for the moment, right? Like, she's really a woman for the moment. Perhaps the polar opposite of her would be Roman Polanski. And I wanted to bring up 2011's Carnage, which, great movie. I hope I didn't, or maybe I do hope I did steal one off of you.
No, you know what? I didn't put it down, but I definitely considered it.
Okay. Carnage was a play that was it originally was a play. It was called Les Deux du Carnage, and it was starring Jodie Foster, Kate Winslet, Christopher Waltz, John C. Reilly. It's four people trapped in a room under slightly pettier and less consequential circumstances, I would say.
That's fair.
They were not a portrayal of excellence, these four people. They were a portrayal of pettiness, meanness, grievance, cowardice, vanity. But nonetheless, the dynamic is similar where the evening comes to a head, things become testy, things get really out of hand at one point. I would say that is, it's a bigger, what I'm trying to highlight is the way that a stage writer probably has to work to craft something in space and be like, okay, we're keeping them right here. Maybe they go up to the roof. Maybe these two go into the hallway, right? And to keep the dynamic fresh and moving and not just have it be like blocks and blocks of dialogue going back and forth and just being like, well, here's my idea about the way things are. Oh, well, here's what I think about what you just said. I mean, the pitfalls are so easy, right?
Right, right. Yeah, and I wonder how that process is, because this writer, Kent Powers, also wrote the stage play. And so I wonder the adaptation of your own work, to not go too far into making it totally cinematic, where it's just still just these people in this room for the most part, but just adding things that, you know, help to create a fuller story.
And I haven't seen the play. Do you know whether or not the play contained some of the, you know, like we see, there are some scenes that feel like they were added in, like it's particularly at the beginning, fight scenes. I can't imagine that they had the actual two boxing matches that they highlighted.
Right.
I can't imagine that they pulled that off in on a stage play. And then also there were several scenes with Fergie, with Angelo Dundee and other members of Ali's coterie. I mean, like, I don't imagine that, like, do you know whether or not they had those in the stage play or no?
I don't. And I had kind of just assumed that the play was literally just what happens in the room, but I could be wrong about that though.
I think that would be, again, I haven't seen the play, so I have to, you know, confess ignorance, but like, it seems like the coolest way to do the play would be like literally the fight's over. And the first thing that we see is Sam Cooke walk into the room and that part, which I think is about 16 or 17 minutes into the movie.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
What's next, Dave?
So I'm going to also do a play to film. It's 2008's Ron Howard film Frost Nixon.
I thought about this one.
Yeah. It's a really solid film about the interview between David Frost and Richard Nixon, 1977. And it's similarly talky, you know, and it's based on a real event where this isn't necessarily a real event, although these are real people and they were actually friends and they probably did meet up at many times, you know, similar to this. But this is all dramatized. But Frost Nixon does, from what I understand, dramatize a lot of the, preamble up to the actual interview. And so it's, first of all, like we were talking about, that adaptation of a stage play into film, and then also basing it on real people and real events, and then dramatizing it in a way to heighten what that is all about.
Yeah, I think that's a good pick. I love Frost Nixon, and
great movie.
And you know, there is that move. And I don't know if this is someone that you still have left, so maybe I'm shitting on you a little bit here, but
it's
like, there are two things that I didn't want to add to this list, and they are, Frost Nixon doesn't do this. A lot of times when you fictionalize events that are likely to have happened and you put your own spin on them, they come out incredibly corny. And there's two things I was thinking about. One is Hamilton, which I detested and which was so corny. I understand it's a reimagining, and I mean, like, obviously it is what it is. It's this new genre, but I did not, it's a semi-new genre. But taking those modern sensibilities and slapping them onto something like that and kind of shoehorning it in, Hamilton at least had some pretty good music. I kind of enjoyed some of the musical numbers. And of course, what's the actor's name? Dave, who plays Sam Cooke. He's incredible in Hamilton as much as I don't like Hamilton.
Leslie Odom Jr.
Leslie Odom. I can never remember his name. Leslie Odom Jr. is just unbelievably talented, but I don't like Hamilton. Yeah. I absolutely detested with every fiber of my being the trial of the Chicago Seven that did the same thing. One of the absolute most fucking dog shit movies I've seen in years. Where,
which, by the way, is going to be up for every Oscar.
Every fucking Oscar. because they didn't give him his Oscar for A Few Good Men, or maybe they did. I don't know. And now, like, this is the move that they do, because they go by 30, they wait 30 years and they're like, oh, we should have given it to you for A Few Good Men.
Well, and it's also anti-Trump, you know, that in the air. And so people just want to, you know, get political, but in that kind of, you know, right, centrist Democrat political way. Ugh,
the worst. God. It's dog shit. So anyway, a movie that I think did that well. Mm-hmm. And I only saw this once. And I honestly, this movie was like one of those smooth round orbs that you kind of, it was very like non-controversial. Although it was a really well done movie, it was a beautiful movie, it was 2016's Loving. Did you ever see Loving, Dave?
Sure, yeah, great movie.
So, directed by Jeff Nichols,
I love him so much.
Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga, who I went on to do like 4 seasons of Preacher, and then like has she done much other than that?
She has not done much in film, that's for sure.
She should be in film more. She was incredible in this, and she's great in everything. But I don't know. I thought she was going to have a much bigger career. I don't know. Whatever. It's only been 5 years. She could probably still just be huge or whatever. Yeah. But this is something that happened, right? State of Virginia versus Loving. And it was, oh my God, how long ago was it that black people weren't allowed to get married to white people? 90 years, 110 years? No, dude, it was like 45 years ago. It was not that long ago. And, or 55 years ago, I suppose, 50-ish years, whatever, when the movie was made. And it tells that story of, you know, the legal battle for these two people to be able to get married. And again, just like with One Night in Miami, you think that these things, I mean, if you're a person of color, you don't think this, but if you're, right, I think if you're a white person, you probably do think like that this is ancient history, this mm-hmm. stuff. And it's not. It isn't at all. It's very recent that all of this stuff was codified and it was law and it was the way of the land. So I picked Loving for that reason, and also because it was obviously a fictionalization, right, of what happened, because we have some contemporaneous ideas of what happened, just like we do have some contemporaneous ideas of what happened on that one night in Miami that Ali won the heavyweight championship of the world. But we don't know the exact dialogue, you know, it wasn't all recorded or whatever. Same thing with the Supreme Court case of Loving versus Virginia. So, Loving 2016. You remember that movie at all or no?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great movie. And it was such an interesting movie for Jeff Nichols to do after like Mud and, you know, all those things that he was kind of known for. It was like a really interesting left turn. But that actually makes me wonder about Regina King as a director, just briefly before going to our next puzzle piece. Like, this is an interesting pick to, like, you know, adapt a stage play like this. I mean, it's to get these kinds of people that it's about, you know, these, I don't want to call them characters. I mean, they're real people, but you know what I mean? Right. Yeah. To make a movie about them that makes sense. I'm curious to see what her voice as a filmmaker is going forward though.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because like you and I had a text chat a few days ago about Zack Snyder, right? Mm-hmm. Does anybody ask what Zack Snyder's voice as a filmmaker is? Zack Snyder has only ever adapted IP. He's literally never done anything that on his own. Like from the what do you call it? Land of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead. Yeah.
Fucking great movie. But guess what? It was a George Romero universe movie, right? Yeah. Before the idea of expanded universes, that was a George Romero expanded universe movie. And virtually everything else, actually not virtually, literally everything else that he's done has been IP. Mm-hmm. I would say that what Regina King has done here is probably a lot more challenging, because look at all the shit that Quentin Tarantino got just for taking tiny liberties with Bruce Lee. By the way, liberties that a lot of people who knew Bruce Lee agree were not that far from the truth. Like, yeah, Bruce right. Lee was kind of a, you know, a egotistical prick, like in real life, which, I mean, fuck, he's Bruce Lee. He deserves to be an egotistical prick. Totally. I would be too. He's yeah. fucking Bruce Lee. But I mean, like, heaven forbid, you know, somebody and
well, she is getting some trouble for Kingsley Ben-Adir playing Malcolm X, who's a British actor. And yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's not my place to really comment on it too
Obama
much. But
X.
Like, yeah, like, is that a problem? Like, I don't know.
That's an old gripe, right? Like, I mean, they I don't know. What are the contours of the complaints? Is it like that? You know, he's
that it should
a
it shouldn't be a British person.
He's like a. I don't know. I don't know enough to understand the contours of the complaints, unless it's just the general, there's that general sentiment that Brits take all the best American roles, but that's
across, I guess there's that too.
That's across color lines. That's like not just black. That's like, I mean, that fucking terrible movie or TV show that I just got done watching, Going Down or whatever, Falling Apart. No, The Undoing. The Undoing.
Oh God, that was
it
awful.
Shows it. Yeah, but did you notice that? I looked it up. Every single person with a speaking role in this Upper West Side based, like New York City, Manhattan based television show, every single person is either British or Australian or Irish or
That's
Welsh.
True, actually, I
there's
thought
not
about
not
that.
A single American actor. Even the little kids are putting on, and then you wonder why they like. You're like, it's like this high end. Really well acted, well made TV show, but like you'll hear like a random actor will be like, "Hey, we got a head on over there," and you're like, "Why are you talking that way? That's not how
that's
Americans
not,
talk.
That's not working that? At all."
And then like some guy, like a cabbie will be like, "Hey, what's up? You're going out over there to Long Island today. LIE is really backed up," and you're like, "Let me look this guy up," and he's like. Like Hertfordshire, England, or something like that. He's from some fucking like Derbylandia or some shit like that. Anyway, whose turn is it?
Oh yeah, it's up to me. I'll go with my next piece, and this is actually a movie I just watched for the first time since middle school for an Awesome Movie Year episode. It is 1984's Best Picture winner, Amadeus. Which is just one of the best movies
Holy
of all
shit.
Time.
What was it with middle school? Did your like music teacher show you that?
Yeah, apparently. I posted on Facebook asking if anybody remembered from my school, and they totally all remembered. I wasn't sure about it.
Mine too. My middle school teacher showed me that movie too, and we all loved it because there's farting. And
oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since then, though. I mean,
it's so good. It holds up so damn well. But yeah, I picked it, though, because, it's this totally dramatized version of and fictionalized version of what these two famous characters in history, Amadeus Mozart and Salieri, what their rivalry could have been, what their friendship could have been, and like the whole back and forth between them. And in this movie, One Night in Miami, we're getting this, again, this fictionalized version of these four friends all meeting these very famous people from throughout history. And so it's, I think, a very similar thing in that you're kind of seeing behind closed doors what might have been between these people. And it's just such a damn good movie. And we brought up F. Murray Abraham earlier in this conversation. This is the second time. So
cool. I don't really remember it that much, to be honest with you. Like
you need to rewatch it. It's so good.
I know it's insane, right? It's yeah. like isn't it? It's like a very like Baz Luhrmann-y like crazy shit, right?
Yeah, I guess it would be definitely like the biggest influence on someone like that for sure.
Yeah. I guess I'll rewatch it. It's long though, right? It's like five hours.
It's very long. And we talk about this a lot on Awesome Movie Year, but like they have pretty much erased the original cut, which was 2 hours and 40 minutes. And only the 3 hour director's cut exists at this point. You have to find a rare DVD to watch the original cut. So, but everybody should watch it.
Well, I got one piece left and
okay.
It was more like an add on. It's not like a home run swing or anything. It's just like a little movie that I think has been forgotten, along with broadly, and maybe I'm wrong about this, I didn't check his IMDb, but this movie's been forgotten along with the overall ambitions of Steve Buscemi to become a director, which he wanted to do a number of years ago. He wanted to be a director. I know that because our next puzzle piece is 2007's Interview, which starred Steve Buscemi, Sienna Miller, and not really anybody else, just the two of them for about an hour and a half of screen time in a in an apartment in Manhattan, playing sort of a game of tete-a-tete, just kind of going back and forth at each other, criticizing each other. Of course, Steve Buscemi is playing a like a battle-hardened political, cynical political correspondent who's being forced by his magazine to report on a silly pop star, Sienna Miller. Sienna Miller is a much smarter than she seems, very savvy, you know, on the cusp of, I think, like one of the storylines that they set up is that she's sort of like on the cusp of what at that time was social media. She like knows how to manage things digitally. She's like, there's I think something else that comes into play with like recording video, and I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen this movie yet, but there's like, it turns out that she's not the vacuous dumbass that people think she is. I had that piece, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory. It's the whole movie. The two of them are sort of going back and forth with each other in one room, you know, in a limited set. I think that that this did not come from a stage play. I couldn't find any evidence that it had. I think it was an original production by Steve Buscemi.
I think so. Yeah, I think it was original. I hadn't even heard of this movie until recently. We considered it for an Awesome
what?
Movie episode.
How did
actually.
You not know about this movie? This is so up your alley.
I know. I was so shocked when I found out that he had directed a movie. And
it's,
so
it's such a good movie too. It's so good. Yeah. It's really, really good.
I gotta watch it sometime soon for sure. My last piece is two pieces and two very, very obvious ones. Two biopics that were huge deals, Malcolm X and Ali, which I think are kind of impossible to, you know, get away from the shadow of because they're just such big movies. Of course, Malcolm X directed by Spike Lee and Ali by Michael Mann, and with Denzel Washington and Will Smith. I mean, how can those performances not inform a movie where these are two of the main characters? And so, you know, I don't think talking about what are better movies is really a part of the conversation. It's more just that these presences, these larger than life presences, have been portrayed in such memorable ways in the past, right. And so I think that informs this movie in some way.
Yeah, and the wasn't it Mo Better Blues too, which I don't have listed here, but Mo Better Blues I think was if I remember correctly, it had something to do with some of the themes of Sam Cooke's career, where it was like about that sort of independence, that artist independence. I think that it wasn't a biopic per se. It didn't even,
right.
You know, it wasn't about Sam Cooke, but it was like,
those artists of that era. Like,
right. I would say, you know, what's another one that maybe people should check out. I haven't seen it and it's not a movie and I'm just pulling it off the top of my head right now. A little bonus puzzle piece.
Mm-hmm.
No Limit Chronicles. How about that, Dave? The documentary that came out last summer. It was like a five-part, one-hour documentary.
Is this a real thing?
This is a real thing. The No Limit Chronicles about, what was it, Cash Money or No Limit.
Master P and the Golden Platinum Tank.
Yeah, and Master P signed what music critics and music experts have called the greatest deal ever signed.
Yeah,
in the
I believe
history
it.
Of music, he owns every inch of his IP, of his property, of his. He owns the fucking Golden Tank. He owns all of it. All of it is his. None of it is rented. None of it is for show. All of his masters. All of his. You know, when you play, you know, make him say on Spotify. Oh, yeah. When we play like a David Rosen song on Spotify, you get one millionth of a penny when we play. Mm-hmm. When we play Make Him Say on Spotify, he gets like $15. Like he has like the best deal in the world.
When you think about those No Limit CDs back at that time, 90, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, like right around there, those were the kind of albums that should have just been being sold out of someone's trunk And somehow they were in every Sam Goody, every Tower Records across the entire country.
Huge. And
how
and
is that possible?
And they were the first ones to do, like, I would say maybe the only other people that did this were like Beastie Boys, maybe. But like maybe. Where they do the branding, like how am I describing it? It was a visual identity, and you knew it was a No Limit record,
right?
Like the minute you touched it.
Well, they had those plastic cases too, so those were amazing.
Who was your favorite No Limit soldier?
Probably, I'd have to go with Master P. I mean, but I loved all. Seriously. I mean, I like Mystical. You know,
Snoop,
I mean,
Snoop was technically No Limit.
I know he technically was. You know who I liked? I like Skullduggery.
Oh, I remember Skullduggery. Mine was. Although he ran into some trouble later in life, really right around that time in life, I will say Mystical. Mystical was the fucking best, dude. He was so good, but yeah, I mean, I don't support any of his extracurricular activities.
Let's down just the road. Say that.
But he was great, man. Come on, Mystical.
Oh yeah, some classics right there. Well, I'll do the finish puzzle and then we'll wrap this thing up. The movies we talked about here were Muhammad Ali, Made in Miami, Inside Llewyn Davis, Carnage, Frost Nixon, Loving, Amadeus, Interview, Malcolm X, and Ali. And of course, that No Limit documentary series, which I really need to watch.
The No Limit Chronicles. It came out on BET over the summer, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I had randomly seen it. But like, hey, man, that's black excellence. Owning your shit. Owning every inch of your shit. Not letting some motherfucker, you know, lay claim to it.
You don't know about this, but me, Random, and Demise have been planning for years to do a No Limit album that just sounds from front to back like a No Limit classic, like 98, 99 album.
You guys rap?
Oh, yeah, that's true. I don't say that on the show. Anyway, let's close up One Night in Miami. You like this movie overall?
I did like it. I did like it. I didn't like – it took a little – look, if you're going to watch this movie, if you haven't yet, be ready because – the sort of, I don't want to say cheesiness, but like the on the noseness of the dialogue, would you agree is a little like I don't like this historical, the historical reimagining stuff. I hate it when like one character will walk up and be like, damn, Sam Cooke, can't believe that you just had 4 number one chart topping hits over the last 7 months. You're the first ever person to do that. I hate the forced exposition and the dialogue. I hate that. And this is a play and it's forced in there. Like it, because that's,
I know what you mean. It. And I feel like it really kind of peters off once we get to the hotel room and it's not so bad, but it's mostly that first like 15 minutes or so where you get a lot of that kind of stuff. And I totally know what you mean. But it definitely gets better.
I would say that in the hotel room, there's this scene where they give the Cassius Clay character a lot of expositional shit to say that comes across very corny, and they really want you to know like, oh, well, this is the Muhammad Ali that people will see later. And it's just a little forced. I can't imagine Muhammad Ali actually being in that room and putting on that sort of like show with people that he actually knows, especially knowing that, like we know now, a lot of what Muhammad Ali did was a show. He was like, he would turn it off, you know, when he was in private moments and, you know, so I don't know. I felt like that was forced and a little silly, but that's nitpicking. I'm nitpicking. Right. I like this movie a lot. I think this movie stands as the one thing I don't like is when movies like this become analogs. Like when movie people or film people or culture writers or whatever try to take movies like this and make them analogs for our current moment.
Right.
Which is a lot of what's happening right now. It's like a prescient movie, a movie that is like so relevant for our times. And it's like, it's really not relevant for our times. And it's pretty fucking disrespectful to the people who actually achieved everything that was achieved in the civil rights era to say that our time is like then. Like, you can be black now and go get a hotel room at the Fontainebleau. And that's because of the things that those people did. And there's a different set of inequities, and there's a different set of social justice chasms that need to be crossed and filled. And like, I think I hate that. I hate when people take a movie like this and they're like, wow, things really haven't changed, huh? To this day. And it's like, no, motherfucker, they have changed. You missed the point of the movie. These people did change something. And like, and this should be a movie like this should be a celebration of that. Like I said before, it's like, it's black excellence. It's like revolutionary people that did incredible things to varying degrees. And I think it's great.
Awesome. Well, let's close it on that. That's a very positive note to close it on. So do you have another movie you watched recently you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Have you talked about The Kid Detective yet on your on this or no?
No, I'm actually going to be recording an episode with Josh Bell, but I would love more people to watch it before we get around to that episode. Why don't, why don't you tell people about it?
Watch The Kid Detective. It got panned, by the way. What the fuck was that? I read after you, Dave recommended this movie. It's, you know, Adrian Brody, or not Adrian Brody, what's his name? Adam Brody. Sorry. Adam Brody.
I could see Adrian Brody playing this role though, possibly.
10 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie was quirky, great, weird. If you're like me, if you like movies that are like these odd neo-noir style movies that are kind of fucked up, I don't know. I feel like I'm not doing it justice in my explanation. Watch it. It's great. Don't read the reviews. You recommended it to me. I watched it. I was like affected enough by it that I wanted to look up and see what other people had said about it. Universally panned. Everybody hated this movie.
It's very, very strange. And I don't understand it. I mean, it does have its fans. It's not like it's everybody that hated it. But yeah, it's very strange. And also, I think that it's in this weird post-COVID world, burying a movie means releasing it to theaters first with no planned digital release strategy whatsoever. This movie came out in theaters only in October with no digital date in sight whatsoever. And I basically waited 3 months.
Pissed somebody off to do this.
I don't understand it. It's so strange. But yeah, it just all of a sudden came out on VOD last week. And so people definitely should watch it. And yes, we will have an episode coming up in a week or two.
You know what else I watched, Dave?
What did you watch?
I watched Southland Tales. Wow. Wow. I can't believe I missed out on that back in 2006.
You need to go back to our Missing Pieces episode and listen to it. Did that guy ever
make another movie?
He made something called The Box, which I never did see. It's with Cameron Diaz. Did you see that?
Doesn't even sound familiar.
Okay. Yeah. No, it came and went, and I don't think he's made anything since.
This is the guy that made Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
And you can tell coming off of Donnie Darko, he could dial up anything. Like they were like, the entire world is your oyster. You can do whatever you want. And he was like, oh, I want that wrestler in my movie. Hello, Mr. The Rock. Yes,
Like Sean William Scott. I want two of him.
I did read a thing where it said that he had a strategy where he wanted to get people that were like underutilized in some way, like they were never properly used, that he felt that they were never properly used.
And that makes sense. That
whatever. Makes sense. Go watch Southland Tales, I guess.
Yes, watch that too. Well, Q, why don't you tell people what's going on over on Bird Road?
Bird Road, we're following the news, man. We're getting balls deep into the Biden administration. Donald Trump is gone. That means that the country's perfect again. Everything's fine.
Yes.
COVID is gone, obviously, because of that.
We can just coast from here on out.
Check us out, Bird Road Podcast. You know, Miami-based leftists, you know, culture, politics, news. Absurdist impressions and things like that.
And all of that. So everybody check it out.
Come on, everybody. Hi, this is Wax Trax Records here on 2909 South Decatur. We buy all your old 45s, your old albums, any type of music memorabilia. Also, we sell music memorabilia, albums, CDs, and a lot. Come on down to Wax Trax, 2909 South Decatur, or give me a call at 702-362-4300. Thank you very much.
All right, so I hope you enjoyed that conversation about One Night in Miami. Thank you to Q for joining me for that one. Everybody, make sure to check out Bird Road. We've been doing a lot of great episodes over there lately, and you should be listening. If you listen to Piecing It Together, you should be listening to Bird Road. So as always, I want to remind you, make sure you are subscribed to Piecing It Together wherever it is you listen to podcasts. You could also follow us on social media at Piecing Pod and join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all the movies we talk about here on the show and a whole lot more. And also, we've got a Patreon, the Produced by David Rosen Patreon, where I combine content from Piecing It Together, Awesome Movie Year, all my podcast-related stuff, as well as my music career stuff, my David Rosen albums and my film scoring. And I'm actually in the middle of working on a new feature film right now, which once it's done, you know, assuming everything goes well, which I'm sure it will, but I'm going to probably put up the whole score as a bonus on the Patreon. So lots of really cool stuff hitting the Patreon soon. So make sure to check that out. It's patreon.com/bydavidrosen, the Produced by David Rosen Patreon. So that does it for today's episode. And we are going to play you out with a piece of music like I always do here on the show. And you know, this movie starts out at one of Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali's, one of his classic fights, and this is a song I produced for a rapper here in Las Vegas named Skydro. It's a song called One More Round, and it's a totally boxing-themed song, so I figured it would be a good fit to play on this episode. So this is One More Round from Skydro's album Success Stories. Check it out. It is available, the whole album, on iTunes and Spotify and all those places. And we'll be back with more Piecing It Together coming up real soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Fight Night, the place guaranteed to get the fight of your life. The stars are shining tonight. Round one.
One more round and I'ma take this crown. One more round and it's going down. One more round and I'ma take this town. One more round and I can settle down. One more round and I'ma take this crown. One more round and it's going down. One more round and I'ma take this town. One more round, one more round.
What's going more down?
Every day you got to fight, that's what they say. Surviving in the eighth while you're trying to get the shade. Down every day you got to fight, that's what they say. Surviving in the eighth, hey. Hey, this is an action pack full of knockout words. Adrenaline in charge, your blows so armed the dangerous. This soundtrack just blew the garage, and a bonus feature can reach across the lot and engulf salutes like a Sarge. First of its kind, a musical motion picture. Picture this, my lyrics in HD label, most explosive rhyme.
One more round, I'ma take this ground. One more round, and it's going down. One more round, and I'ma take this town. One more round, and I can settle down.
Trying to get the shade. Down every day you got to fight, that's what they say. Surviving in the eight, ay, ay. Put me in ice till I find me good to see on the rocks. Why don't you make it so strong? Somebody calls it cops. So they can say Mr. Freeze, we're running the blocks. And I can say the streets cold, we're running the stops. Feeling like Iron Mike on Fight Night. Way back in his prime, the sequel. Experts did the math, they couldn't find no equal. So they made his blows illegal.
One more round, I'ma take this ground. One more round and he's going down. One more round and I'ma take this town. One more round and I can settle down. One more round and I'ma take this round. One more round and it's going down. One more round and I'ma take this town. One more round, one more round.
What's going down? Down
every day you got to fight, that's what they say. Surviving in the eighth while you're trying to get the shade. Down every day you got to fight, that's what they say. Surviving in the eighth, ay, ay. Up on a rival, here comes survival. Leaving rivals on the ground. Get an extra arm. He's rocking like a Metallica song. Spitting fire from his thumb. Rocky's hitting harder than both sickest. 50 caliber gun.
Dazed and shocked and blinded by flashes of lightning as the thunder proceeds to give him crowns. He's a monster, gods of men. He won all titles and thrones.
One more round and I'ma take this crown. One more round and he's going down. One more round and I'ma take this town. One more round and I can settle down.
Wait a minute, I don't know where the new kid comes back. How is he still standing? A left, up a gun, he's camping down. All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.
All right. Anything you want to go over before we jump in?
I wonder if we're going to have some of the same, some samesies.
I have a feeling we will, but, and I don't really have a lot. So, I mean, you know.
Evil Dead.
Yeah, I definitely have Evil Dead on mine. The way things get crazier and crazier.
Yeah. You know, what happens is, like, it just keeps getting crazier and crazier.